So tell me about the genesis, Terry, if you will, where your just being published novel called I Am Pilgrim began in your head. Where did it come from? Where did it start?
It's a race against time thriller, and I've always been one of those people who loves espionage thrillers. So when I decided that if I wasn't going to write a novel pretty soon, I never would due to advancing years. Yeah. I naturally turned to that genre. It's a pretty well-worn track, really, espionage thrillers, but I think I had a couple of advantages. One is that I've worked in the movies, right, so I did understand something about pacing. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the movies really teach you about being locked into popular culture. So I thought, well, okay, right, other people have done espionage thrillers. Mm-hmm. Other people have gone down this road many times. I'd better make it, of the here and now. So it was a natural sort of progression in the genre, and, there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't say to myself that I am truly blessed that I spent all those years working in the movies. I would have found it very difficult to do the book had I not learned those lessons.
Uh-huh. Well, the main conflict, as I'm reading this now, I haven't read the book, but the main conflict is basically between a guy on our side, so to speak, and a determined Islamic fundamentalist jihadist terrorist, and the...
It's a secret, a covert intelligence agent who takes the codename Pilgrim, right, who has to track down what in reality is the thing that all intelligence agencies in the world fear most, the guy they call the clean skin, a guy that's never appeared on any watch list, on any database, who has stayed completely beneath the radar. It's the hardest thing in the world to find. You don't even know where to start.
Right.
And they get a glimmer of this guy. They catch a fleeting glimpse of this ghost-like figure. And our guy Pilgrim has to go out there and try to find him. Mm-hmm. What they call in the intelligence community a pathfinder.
Right.
A guy who doesn't have to resolve the whole thing, but he has to identify him. Well, of course, having worked in the movies, things get a bit out of hand, and he does have to actually go mano a mano with this particular guy. The Saracen, as he's known, they don't know a name for him. He had to be the most intelligent, the most incredible, jihadist that right. you could think of in order to make Pilgrim a worthy character.
Yeah.
So I sort of elevated both of them, We know that from movies. Mm. The good guy's only ever as good as the bad guy.
Right.
So it became very interesting.
You know, there's at the root of Islamic radicalism, there's a fundamental, I'm sure you're not the only person to dig into this, obviously this is a commonly known, but there's a fundamental disconnect between those guys and their belief that it's got to be somehow the great Satan, which is to say Western culture, has to be undermined, dismantled, terrorized, blown up, and that they're the ultimate glorious triumph of Allah and the Islamic way of life is, it's right out of a pulpy melodrama produced by Samuel Bronson in the 60s. It's something kind of absurd, but these guys are serious. And I don't know how you make dramatic sense out of that kind of fanatical disconnect. I mean, the whole... Did you happen to read about how some Iranian revolutionary group wanted the actress who was on the jury to be...
Oh, yeah, kissing at Cannes, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are not, extreme and passionate. They're loony. They don't seem to fundamentally get anything, much less the 20th century.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a huge, dramatic problem. It's the first thing you confront. You're 100% correct. Yeah. You come out of your office and you walk straight into this big, narrative storytelling problem. And I was fortunate. I was really lucky. I had read an eyewitness account, two Irish guys happened to be living and working in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And as you know, there's very little social events in the Kingdom of Saudi. You can't go to coffee shops with women. There's no movies. There's no, alcohol. There's no parties. So women are not allowed to drive. I mean, it's a pretty tough society. But there is one thing which everybody's welcome to, which is a public beheading.
No.
These two Irish guys, having nothing better to... I mean, believe me, Western people are hard to understand, but they thought, oh, well, there's nothing going on. We'll go down and watch the public beheading, which they did. And I read their eyewitness account of it, which is one of the most awful things that I've read in recent years. And that occurred to me. I thought, you know what? If the Saudi intelligence services, let alone, I mean, they don't have a judicial system worthy of the name, but if they arrested a guy for criticizing the Saudi monarchy, and then his 12-year-old son makes a desperate run to get to the square to see what's happening and actually sees his father beheaded, I thought, that would radicalize you. That would be something which would so scar your soul that anything becomes manageable and believable in a narrative way.
Right.
And so that's what I did. Because I had to confront the problem which you've identified.
Yeah.
And I had to make it understandable and meaningful to a Western reading audience. So that was the genesis of the bad guy, to have that happen to him. And he is a person who has, in many ways, become sort of unhinged, but who wouldn't be? So I started there, and then, of course, you know what storytelling is. You pull on one thread, and everything starts to happen. So that was where it started.
There's a mini, just a sort of a capsule description that describes your book. As reminiscent of Le Carré and Ludlum at their finest, but those are two pretty opposed approaches. I mean, Ludlum is much more plot-driven, and Le Carré is much more atmosphere, psychological, delicate, emotional undercurrents, that sort of thing. Which one do you feel more a kinship with?
Le Carré is a character. I think, Le Carré goes very heavily on character, and Ludlum, as you rightly say, is plot. When I set out to do it, again, it's such a hard thing to try to write, halfway decent movie or a halfway decent novel, and I spent most of my life terrified, I'm going to get it wrong.
Right.
So I thought, it's no good just doing a Dan Brown style thing where a guy's character is derived from what his job description is. You've got to have real character.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know from the movies, a real character comes from a wounded person.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have that wound. And now, whether their character reveals it or hides it or you leave it a mystery, you've got to have it there.
Yeah.
So I took that from Le Carré, but I wanted the pace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've only got to sit in an editing room and live with your mistakes, live with all the faults that you indulged, to know the value of pace. And that's where the Ludlum aspect of it came from.
You know, I was just thinking about that wound. All characters that are interesting have that wound. And I was thinking how when I first saw The Road Warrior, which you co-scripted I know it came out initially in 81 in Australia, but I saw it in 82 in New York. And I remember thinking that I completely understood and believed Mel Gibson's Max character, because you could feel very clearly, without any ambiguity, that he had a pretty awful wound inside him, and it was there, and that's what got me going in that film immediately, because I understood that he was a survivor, but he was pretty, and you didn't have to see the first one to know that.
That's exactly right, and strangely enough, for the first time in 25 years, I saw it on the big screen last night. I'm in Toronto, the film festival, very kindly invited me on there to give an address about the film and answer, you know, do the Q&A thing from the stage and that. So I sat down and watched the movie, which is a terrifying experience, because in your mind, it's a different movie to the one which is on the screen, and you know, you think to yourself, my God, I just hope it lives up to my memory of it. And that was one of the things I really took away from it, that Mel, of course, was very young.
Yeah.
What an accomplished actor. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he conveyed a world of pain without dialogue. I mean, brilliantly directed by George, of course.
Right.
But it was there. Had you cast somebody who didn't or was unwilling, a movie star who was unwilling to convey that anguish, to convey that wound, the film would have lost 50% of its power.
Right, exactly. I was wondering, I mean, I know that you're not involved in the most recent Road Warrior Mad Max film, which I think it was shot sometime in 2012, if I'm not mistaken, and it still hasn't come out. Do you know which one I'm referring to? The more
Fury Road. I've seen quite a bit of it. I live quite a long way north of Sydney, near Brisbane. And anyway, I spoke to George, and he said, "Why don't you come down to Sydney and have a look at some of it, get together." So I took my four kids with me, and very generously, they managed to walk around in Charlize Theron's costume, and you know, they had that wonderful time that kids have to do with movies. And of course, he was in the editing room with it, and he said, "You want to see a fair bit of it?" Well, you know, I said, "Sure." It's a groundbreaker, Jeffrey. It is. Believe me, it's extraordinary. And I have no interest, financial, creative, or anything else in this. It is a total game changer. You know, George, who knows an enormous amount about CGI effects because of, you know, the Happy Feet and all of that, but he also knows the value of doing it for real. And this was an incredible marriage of the use of some computer stuff, but mostly for real.
Right.
It's seamless. It's seamless. It's a filmmaker at the very top of his game. It really is. Incredibly complex film. I know that it's been tested. Obviously, it's been seen by you know, by Warner Brothers and that.
Right.
This is really going to do it.
I thought the whole thing about the Mad Max films is that they're not fantasy. They're raw. They're real. They're out in the desert, in the wasteland, and you know, unless you're talking about the kind of visual effects and CG that are, you said seamless, but does that mean? I mean, you can only be so much of that, because we're talking about actual vehicles and real guys and real terrain. It's not that fantastical, is it?
No, I mean, I mean all the stunts. I mean, all of that. It has that feeling of a person who. So many movies that you see now, I think, are made by people who understand very little beyond CGI effects.
Right.
Now we're talking about a guy who came out of a world where that didn't even exist, but has has, you know, become a master of that,
right.
But he still understands the value of making it real. It's a fantastic piece of work. I mean, it was jaw-dropping, I thought. And George said to me, "Oh, Terry, you know, you're just being generous. You're being really generous." He said, "You know, you would have to watch the whole story through, the whole film through, and see how it works narratively. You know, it's got to have a story." And I said, "Oh, George, come on. You've seen a lot of summer blockbusters. You know, you can count on one hand the ones that have got a really good story."
Right.
So he laughed and he said, "Oh, maybe you're right." So it was going to come out this summer. And my understanding of it is that I think everybody involved felt that it would be something that would be enhanced by it's an incredibly complex film, you know, by having extra time. So he's working assiduously on it. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's coming out in next May, not for a whole year from now.
I don't know this for sure, but they must be very, very close. Not with the sound mix and that, because they've had it in LA a number of times, doing the test screenings and all of that.
Right.
So
right.
I think, you know, it's probably a matter of, hey, what filmmaker in the world wouldn't want more time if you can get it, you know?
Oh, of course, yeah. All movies are never finished. They're just taken away from the directors. So it's a luxury to be able to have that extra time, for sure. Yeah,
and I think that, you know, because George and his producing partner, Doug Mitchell, are working down in Australia, I think it's probably one of the advantages to have some distance between you and Los Angeles.
Yeah. So the... just looking back at and thinking about our friend Philip, can you recount the rewriting and the changes to the ending of Dead Calm, which you were also the writer on? I remember that was I would have loved to have seen whatever the original ending was, because I believe that the studio came in and said, we need to have Billy Zane's character come back from the dead and be a threat again. What did you feel about the first version versus the second version?
I wrote both versions, but I was also the producer on the film, so, you know, I had to take off the writer hat and put the producer hat on. And the fact of the matter was that the first ending, which was enigmatic insofar as that Billy, he went off the boat and sort of disappeared, and you were left with the feeling that, was this all a nightmare? This guy was still out there. It was, I suppose, thinking about it now, I've never thought this before, but I think it's true. I think it was the European ending, Jeffrey. I think it left a lot of questions deliberately unanswered, and they had a very haunting feel to it. Wonderfully shot by Phil. I mean, no doubt of it. The ending conveyed all of these things. It had a great depth to it. And it was enigmatic. Well, you know, you can't sit with Warner's, Burbank there, and enigmatic is not a word that you want to use that often. You know, they sort of look at you, and they, the sirens go off, the security guards are called, you know, enigmatic, for God's sake, are you crazy? We tested the movie, and, you know, it did very, very well, but it needed that sense of relief. My own guess is, and I can't quantify this, but my own guess is, because the opening with Nicole's baby being killed in a car accident is so, like, out there. I remember a test screening in LA where we did that scene, you know, it was up in the movie, this terrible sense of dread coming, the kid goes through the windshield, but that's that. People walked out. I mean, it wasn't that we had a chance to shown that we were either, you know, reasonable filmmakers or lousy filmmakers. We never even got the first base.
Right.
They walked out. Mm. And I thought, but it has this big impact. I think starting like that and then, you know, not resiling from the fact that, you know, Billy Zane has sex with Nicole,
yeah.
It was pretty bold. To then go for an enigmatic ending just didn't tie in with this sort of balls-out approach to a lot of the rest of the film.
Mm.
And Warner's had a very, very persuasive argument. They showed us the cards. And I sat down, I read every test screening card.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the overwhelming feeling was that people needed a sense of release from the film.
Right.
They didn't want to go out thinking Billy Zane was still out there somewhere, might be in the parking lot by now. You know, it's a testament to his performance.
Right, right.
You know, maybe a bit of a testament to the writing, who knows. But they needed a sense of release. Problem with all of these movies is the problem, and I still haven't solved this tonight, I doubt that I ever will, that if you don't do the bad guy coming back so that you can kill him, everybody's disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since Carrie, when the hand comes out of the grave,
it's 4 o'clock.
If you do the bad person coming back or that big shock moment at the end, everybody says, I've seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we managed to get it over the line at the end. Is it perfect? No, it's not. I don't know how it could have been improved, but I feel that it should have been. But I have no regrets about changing the ending. And you know, and Phil was a real mensch about it all. He really was. He was terrific, you know. When you start saying to a director, oh, look, this is what I think we ought to do. But, you know, Phil's rooted in the real world, and he just wanted it to be the best film we could make. And I don't think, you know, we never had, like, any arguments with Waters about it or anything like that. It was just a question of how do you execute it, how do you make it better.
Right. Then there was also the two versions of Payback, which I was very keen on when I first heard about it, which is basically Mel Gibson and you guys redoing, in my mind, you were redoing Point Blank, the Lee Marvin, John Borman film. And then that had a kind of a disputed thing. There was the studio version, and then there was, I think they called it Payback the Ultimate. What do they call it? The different version, the one that was...
I can't remember what marketing term they used. The Brian Helgeland version. The Mel Gibson version. Brian Helgeland's version.
Mm.
Look, you know, tough situation to get yourself into. Mm. Really tough situation. And I never asked for it. Believe me, I didn't. I was working with Mel on a different script, something we're both incredibly passionate about, but, you know, tough to get a movie made. But I was down on a set with him. I think it was Million Dollar Hotel. And
I saw that. That's the Wim Wenders film, right?
Yeah, the Wim Wenders film, he said to me, you know, Mel's very, he won't come out and ask you to do something, but he will lay the groundwork. And he said, you want to have a look at a movie that we've done? And I said, oh, yeah, sure. He said, He said, what's your feeling about narration? He said, that narration in Road Warrior, that seemed to work pretty good, didn't it? I said, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
And he said, because I had a bit of a shit fight. It didn't say with anybody in particular, but people say, oh, narration doesn't work. And it was this sort of fairly laconic sort of thing where you're never quite sure exactly what's going on. So I sat down and watched Payback with him, and he said, what do you think? And I said, I can understand what you mean about narration. I think it'll add a lot to the character. You don't need much, but you could add that in at the beginning, his internal thoughts. I said, and if you did it in a really Raymond Chandler sort of way, it might be real fun. He started to laugh. You know, Mel's very well read, and he kicked that around. And he said, what else do you think? I said, well, you know, you've got a real plot problem at the end. He said, yeah, that's what the cards are telling us. He said, all the scores, he said, are right down as a result of that this narrative problem.
Right.
And he said, I'm damned if I know how to solve it.
Right.
And like an idiot, I said to him, well, you know, what you really need is some, like, really clever idea that the bad guys, have decided to blow Porter up, I said, just for example's sake,
mm-hmm.
And they put this device under his phone. And he goes to the apartment, and he's about to pick the phone up, and the audience say, don't pick the phone up. And then he realizes. And so he doesn't do it. I said, da-da-da-da-da, you do a whole lot of other narrative stuff. And then the bad guys go to the apartment. And what does Porter do? He calls the phone. The bad guys have forgotten they put the bomb, they blow themselves up. I said, so you need something where, you lay the pipe, you pay it off a little bit, and then you come back, the audience has forgotten about it, and you nail it at the end. And
right.
So we've got to try and think of something like that. And he looked at me and he said, are you stupid?
Right.
I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you've just done it. He said, well, are we going to sit down and think about it? I said, shit, that would work, wouldn't it? And so we sat down, and then we worked backwards from that. Well, Brian's a very, very nice guy.
Hmm.
That's not a pleasant sort of position to be in. But having opened my big mouth and Mel telling me that he thought that we had some sort of, storytelling solution, I didn't feel like I could then say, oh, no, I'm not sure this is the right thing to do or whatever. You always use this this expression, the movie gods. The harsh masters, these movie gods, and sometimes they demand human sacrifice. So,
that's funny.
So I said, okay, and we worked through how to narratively get that to work.
Mm-hmm.
What would we need to reshoot? What would we need to adjust? What would we do here?
Right.
And, I think Brian would agree, because it's a fact, that the test scores, changed very, very dramatically. Warner's became really, really high on the movie.
Mm.
And, what had been a very troubled or problematic film became a film that received, quite widespread, support, both critically and box office.
Yeah, yeah. I had one issue. I always loved Lee Marvin's name in Point Blank, Walker, a guy who walks, who strides down airports, a man with a purposeful stride in his soul. And the original literary character was named Parker, I believe, right? Like a guy who knows how to park it, who parks cars, who knows where to put things. And then Porter sounds like a guy who works in a hotel.
That's Brian. See, this is the great thing about Playback. Anything you like about it, I can say I did. Anything that that's problematic for you, that's Brian. The names had been had already been determined. But there were three guys: Resnick, Bronson, and some other guy who were the three guys that ran the organisation. When I'm writing I Am Pilgrim, one of the characters in it has three lawyers who run his trust fund. And I thought, same old thing, got to think up the names. And I thought, oh, no, I don't. I'll take those names from Payback. And so there they are on the printed page in Pilgrim.
That's good. All right, man. This is great. Been talking to you. You have to go somewhere or something, right?
They wheel me out. I'm sort of like, this trained dog. They come and grab me, wheel me out. I say a few things and they wheel me to the next place. So, I got to run and do some more and try and get people to buy the book.
If we're all in Los Angeles at the same time, it'd be great to you and me to Philip to get together. I would look forward to that.
absolutely. I'm there from June the 10th. I've got your email.
Yeah.
I'll drop you an email and let you know. I'm going to stay on for a few days. Obviously, Pilgrim has occasioned quite a bit of excitement amongst the film industry, so I've got to take some meetings and do all of that. So I'll drop you an email. We'll go have a bite or a cup of coffee.
That'd be great. Sure.
Again, love to catch up with you. You can tell me all the Lex G stories, which which would make a film.
Hey, by the way,
you're having a really good day. Enjoy Paris with your son and with your significant other, and go to Venice. And I'm deeply envious. I'm going to Detroit, St. Louis, and I don't know, some other places I've never been before, and I'm sure I probably won't go back to. But have a lot of fun.
All right, man. Really great talking to you.
Great talking to you.
All right, take care.